Good evening, and welcome to this special edition of Outbeat Radio we call Outbeat Extra. I'm Greg Moralia. Tonight, Outbeat Radio remembers Matthew Shepard and how he's changed the world. The story began in October of 1998 with a 21-year-old aspiring political science major named Matthew Shepard, who had just started his first semester at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. He had just discovered a passion for political science and dreamed of someday changing the world. On the night of October 6, 1998, Matthew Shepard stopped into the Fireside Lounge in Laramie to have a beer. Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson, also both 21 years old, spotted Matthew sitting at the bar. They approached him and convinced him to leave with them. After driving Matthew across town, Russell tied Matthew's hands behind his back at the base of a fence and held him while Aaron McKinney beat him with the butt end of an 8-inch revolver. Russell and Aaron left Matthew unconscious until he was found 18 hours later. He never regained consciousness, and he died 5 days later in a hospital with his family around him. The story of this vicious hate crime shook the entire world. People responded by holding vigils, marches, and protests. Some wrote songs, while many others wrote letters. McKinney and Henderson were eventually both convicted of murdering Matthew Shepard and were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Tonight, we remember Matthew Shepard and share with you some of the many examples of how he has changed the world in ways he could have never ever imagined. But first, here's this week's Outbeat Radio News. And here's your Outbeat Radio News for this Sunday, October 30th, 2011. California's largest LGBT rights advocacy group is on shaky ground, at least according to Senator Mark Leno, one of the state's most prominent gay politicians. Leno told the Bay Area Reporter that Equality California's staffing and funding at this point appear to be uncertain and unstable. Equality California is also still smarting from this month's resignation of Executive Director Roland Palencia, who quit just 3 months after taking the job. Palencia says that he left the job for personal reasons and was not forced out. The organization's finance director, government affairs director, and marriage and coalitions director are also on their way out. No interviews for replacements are currently taking place, and spokesman Rebecca Orr told the Bay Area Reporter that donations are on the decline, especially since most people give to the nonprofit when a campaign is gearing up. Equality California recently decided not to attempt undoing Proposition 8 at the ballot in 2012, but instead they will be launching a public education campaign to encourage acceptance for full LGBT equality. And on the heels of last week's federal court ruling that California's Proposition 8 supporters are not entitled to protect the identities of their donors from the public, anti-gay Christian groups are expressing fear of retaliation by marriage equality supporters for financially supporting the measure, which added an amendment to California's constitution making same-sex marriage illegal. While California law requires that political campaigns must reveal the identity of anyone who donates more than $100, James Bopp, a high-profile attorney for religious right causes, has vowed to continue fighting for an exemption in this particular case. And here in the North Bay, the Community Media Center of the North Bay, which airs programming produced by and of interest to the LGBT community, faces budgetary cuts that will result in a loss of critical services. The center provides to its members all of the equipment, including a fully equipped television studio, needed to produce programming that is broadcast on one of 4 cable access channels that not-for-profit manages. The Media Center has strived to serve as Sonoma County's news source after Channel 50 stopped producing its local evening news 4 years ago. Once a staunch supporter, the members of the City of Santa Rosa City Council and City Administration appear less than willing to agree to a new contract that would keep the Community Media Center from having to lay off staff and cut back services. The Community Media Center is funded by franchise fees paid to the City of Santa Rosa by cable provider Comcast, whose representatives 14 years ago struck a deal with the city for a right-of-way access in return for building and funding the Media Center. In 2003, the center was nationally recognized as a model in local television when it was featured in PBS's Bill Moyers Now. Faced with a budget crisis, the City of Santa Rosa's management has been underpaying the Community Media Center more than $160,000 while collecting the full amount from Comcast. The city has imposed a $70,000 reduction in fees to the Community Media Center after the board of the Community Media Center agreed to such a reduction in 2008. The city has not collected some $200,000 in fees from AT&T after asking the media center to provide equipment space for the cell phone provider. The center's executive director, Dan Villava, said initial meetings with the city of Santa Rosa were quite productive, but after our discovery of extensive underpayment of contractual fees and other issues, that process stalled. The funding proposal we have put forth would actually increase the franchise fees retained to the city's general fund. We hope to make up the shortfall by fundraising, increased production services, and cost-cutting measures. We're working in good faith with the city, but cannot ignore the fact that the city staff has negatively affected the media center's ability to operate and serve the North Bay. Now here's your calendar of events for the coming week. On Tuesday, November 1st at 6 p.m., the Trans Group will meet at the Positive Images Center, 312 Chin Street in Santa Rosa. And on Wednesday, November 2nd at 6 p.m., Marin's Women Seeking Women, an informal social group, will gather at Jason's Restaurant, 300 Drake's Landing in Greenbrae. And on Thursday, November 3rd, Spectrum hosts the Caregiver Forum and Dinner for LGBT caregivers who care for LGBT older adults at home or in an assisted living facility. That event will take place from 5 to 7 p.m. at Jackson's Cafe at the Whistle Stop, 930 Tamalpais Avenue in San Rafael. And also Thursday at 7 p.m., the Men for Men support group will meet at the Marin AIDS Project, 910 Irwin Street in San Rafael. And finally, on Saturday, November 5th, from 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., Food for Thought, Sonoma County's AIDS Food Bank Drive happens at the Guerneville Safeway and the Bicentennial Safeway in Santa Rosa. If you have news or an event you'd like to share with our listeners, be sure to tell us about it by going to our own website at outbeatradio.com. Just click on Outbeat Radio News. For Gary Carnevale, I'm Greg Moralia.
In the early hours of October 7, 1998, in Laramie, Wyoming, a senseless act of hate led to the death of a young man with a promising future. His death affected the nation and the world.
Police say Shepard was lured from this Laramie night spot. He was later robbed, beaten, and left for dead, tied to this fence post outside of town.
The first reports of Matt's attack started showing up Thursday night on some of the Denver stations, and it was reported as a gay bashing or a possible hate crime.
When we saw him, it was like he didn't even look like Matt. He had stitches all over his face, and he was swollen, and bandages all over his head, and
he was basically begging. He was asking them to stop hitting him, telling them that they were hurting him, not to hurt him anymore.
We didn't want him to feel the trauma of the whole thing, so we played his favorite music. We sprayed his cologne around the room.
Early this morning, freshman Matthew Shepard died from injuries he received in a vicious beating.
Authorities charged two men, Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson, with Shepard's murder.
Dennis said, just leave me in a room with them alone for 10 minutes and I'll take care of the whole thing. Of course, we knew we couldn't do that.
The only place that he didn't have any blood on him on his face was what appeared to be where he'd been crying down his face.
None of it made any sense to us. The degree of violence was just, it was horrific. Later, we came to understand that when it's a hate crime, this is a definite signal of a hate crime, that level of violence.
Today, on the University of Wyoming campus, there were armbands and mourning for a student whose death has focused national attention on hate and violence.
I am so pissed off.
President Clinton is urging Congress to expand a federal hate crimes law following the beating death of a gay student in Wyoming. Matthew Shepard died at a Colorado hospital yesterday after he was brutally attacked last week. Cynthia Bowers reports.
We shall overcome.
Friends and supporters of Matthew Shepard gathered at sunset last night.
I knew deep down immediately that this was going to be a hugely important story for our community, and that how the media covered this was going to have a huge impact on people's perceptions of the gay and lesbian community.
When the media hit Laramie, again, I think it was an opportunity for Laramie to step up, show the pride in that community, to show that we don't condone any kind of activity like that.
I remember greeting people as they came in. Some we knew and some we didn't. I remember the beautiful service, the beautiful music. And Matt had been cremated, and his urn was in a beautiful oak box in front of the altar. And it had a ceramic mountain scene on it, and everybody would touch it when they went by.
McKinney will be the first to stand trial. Russell Henderson pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 2 consecutive life terms earlier this year.
Aaron McKinney sentenced to 2 life sentences. One of those life sentences is for his conviction for felony murder and second degree murder.
More than a year ago, our son Matthew was murdered because he was gay. He was the victim of a brutal crime motivated by hatred. The outcome of this trial will never bring Matthew back to us. But we believe that justice was served today.
I think Matthew Shepard's death was one of those unique events in American history that galvanized most hearts beyond bias.
News about what happened to Matthew Shepard spread quickly throughout not only the LGBT community, but penetrated through every corner of the mainstream media. People responded immediately in different ways, some with anger and outrage, and others with extreme sorrow that they shared in letter and in song. One of the first and best-known songs written about Matthew Shepard was created by singer-songwriter Randy Driscoll.
I remember I was living in San Diego at the time, and there was a lot of news coverage about the beating of Matthew Shepard. And just like everybody else, I was sort of fixated on the television. I remember watching the story, and I was horrified and truthfully disgusted at the brutality and the hate. And I was, I was stuck on watching the story progress. And then finally, unfortunately, you know, Matthew Shepard's passing. And specifically, I remember hearing the words from Dennis and Judy Shepard, his parents, talking about unconditional love and loving your children. And I really had a strong sense of their family. And so I was saddened at what happened to them and their family. And I was outraged at what another human could do. Well, the song came, the song What Matters came from hearing Matthew's story. And really, for as an artist, as a songwriter, I needed a way to process what I was feeling, because I was really upset and I kind of didn't know what to do with it. So I always say that my therapy is my piano. So I went into my space, and I got on my keyboard and I started writing a song that I finished in about 45 minutes to an hour. It just sort of, the song sort of spilled out of me, and it was really my reaction to this young man's death. But strangely, the song was really more the story of what I thought his family represented and this unconditional love that I felt coming from them. So the song was sort of my way of coping, you know, my coping mechanism. And at the time, I had no intentions for the song. It was really personal. I didn't think I would ever perform it live. But the history of the song is that I a few nights later performed the song at a coffee house in San Diego. And it was actually the people's reaction to the song. It was a brand new song for me. So I think I probably introduced the song, I explained what it was about, and I closed my eyes. And when I finished the song, I opened my eyes, and the audience was sort of like standing together and holding one another, and several of them were crying. And a lot of people came up to me that evening, and they told me that the song had really affected them because Matthew's story had affected them. So at that time, I knew that I was not the only one that was dealing with something. And of course, obviously, from all the vigils that happened and the response of the world, this story was something that really cut to people's core, because I think as a whole, humans were tired of hate inflicted on other humans.
You were the brightest angel heaven had ever seen. You walked in with the story to tell, 10,000 tongues to scream. And you said, doesn't your heart beat the same as mine? Haven't I told you 1,000 times? Isn't the air in my lungs the same air? So who cares whose arms I'm all wrapped up in? Who cares whose arms I see myself in? Who cares who I dream of? Who cares who I love? Yeah. Heaven help me, for I am lost. What a price my love did cost. And here I am standing strong. And sunrise, and don't we all sleep in the same moonlight? And tell me, isn't the blood in my veins the same blood you bleed? So who cares whose arms I'm all wrapped up in? Who cares whose arms myself in? Who cares who I dream of? Who cares who I love? When I die, when they lay my body,
when they lay my body,
brings you all around, brings us all around. Tell me, doesn't my mother cry like everyone? My father grieve for his lonely son. Isn't my rainbow a little brighter? Because so who cares whose arms I'm all wrapped up in? Who cares whose eyes I see myself in? Who cares who I dream of? No, it doesn't matter who I dream of.
Shortly after debuting the song that night, Randy sent a copy to the Shepherds. They immediately embraced it. Randy donates the proceeds from the sale of this song, and so far has raised well over $40,000 that's been used by the Matthew Shepherd Foundation to fund hate crime prevention programs and education. And another well-known musician heard about Matthew's story at his home in England.
It really, really had a huge impact, not just on me, but I'm sure anyone who read that story, it had the most devastating effect. I felt such pangs of anger and sorrow.
Later that year, Elton John came to Laramie, Wyoming, and performed a concert that he dedicated to Matthew Shepherd and to other victims of hate. He wrote a song about Matthew that was used later by NBC for a television movie about Matt, states, donating all of the proceeds to the Matthew Shepherd Foundation.
Seen him playing in his backyard, a young boy just starting out. So much history in this landscape, So much confusion, so much doubt. Been there drinking on that front porch. Angry kids, mean and dumb. Looks like a painting, that blue skyline. God hates facts, where we come from. Western skies don't make it right. Home of the brave don't make no sense. I seen a scarecrow wrapped in a wire, let to die on a high ridge fence. It's a cold, cold world. It's a cold, cold world. It's a cold wind blows Wyoming. See two coyotes running down a deer. Hate what we don't understand. You pioneers, give us your children. But it's your blood that stains their hands. Western skies don't make it right. Home of the brave don't make no sense. I've seen the scarecrow wrapped in a wire, let them die on a high ridge fence. It's a cold, cold world. It's a cold, cold world. Folks up ahead, to ignorance and innocence. Three lives drift on different winds. Two lives ruined, one life spent. Western skies don't make a right. Of the brave don't make no sense. I seen a scarecrow wrapped in a wire, let to die on a high ridge fence. It's a cold, cold world. It's a cold, cold world. It's a cold wind blowing Wyoming. It's a cold, cold.
Four weeks after the murder of Matthew Shepard, nine members of the New York-based Tectonic Theater Project traveled to Laramie, Wyoming, to collect interviews with people of the town. 2 years later, and after more than 200 interviews, a play called The Laramie Project opened in Denver, Colorado, in November of 2000. Greg Perotti is one of the writers and original members of the cast.
Well, you know, when we first went out, we really had no idea what to expect. And in fact, we did not go out with the intention of writing a play. We went out to see if a play could be written. So the entire first trip was an exploration of whether there was something, some story there to tell. I mean, I really didn't go out there with a lot of expectation around what the artistic product would be. Lee Fondakowski and I were the first people to go to Laramie. We went out ahead of the rest of the company, and I remember we were coming over the mountain pass, you know, on Route 80 between Cheyenne and Laramie, and as we came over the pass and saw, you know, what we referred to later in the play as the twinkling lights of Laramie, Wyoming, we had been chatting and laughing and talking. You know, we were just actually getting to know each other as collaborators at that time, and we came over the pass and we saw Laramie and we both felt dead silent. And I know we were just both terrified, you know, personally terrified. And I mean, that view of Laramie changed rather rapidly, but I think all of us in the company were more just thinking about our own personal relationship to the story at that point. And it wasn't until actually we had collected all of the material and returned to New York and actually spent time in a workshop creating an initial reading, which bared very little resemblance to what the play ultimately ended up being. And we performed that, you know, or did a reading of that for our colleagues, our friends and colleagues in the New York theater world. And they really gave us the mandate. You know, we were so in the material and immersed. I mean, we knew we were interested, but we still really didn't have any notion of like, oh my gosh, can this be done? And then we read what we created, you know, kind of in our isolated experience. And it was the people who came to see the reading that said, wow, this is incredibly powerful content and material, and it's your obligation to make this play happen. And that's when we proceeded to go back. I mean, you know, we made, I think, 7 separate trips. But when I went to the fence for the first time, I just was not really prepared for the level of compassion that I was going to experience for, you know, for Matthew and for all queer people who have had to deal with this kind of hostility and prejudice. You know, it was just, it was a truly spiritual experience for me. I put my hand on the fence and I felt like just a level of compassion, you know, compassion meaning suffering with, you know, not like, oh, poor everybody, but like just being a part of this community that has suffered so terribly and like really feeling, you know, what Matthew must have experienced all alone on the prairie that night. It was overwhelming to me.
I love this land. I really love this land. Laramie is a beautiful town. It's secluded. You know, now, after Matthew, we're a town defined by an accident or a crime.
Where are you going with this story?
I've never done anything like this before. How do you get people to talk to you? What do you ask?
Are you going to use our words?
In the years that followed, the Laramie Project would play in cities throughout the United States, and in 2002, HBO released a movie version of the play.
When I got to the fence, I seen what appeared to be a young man. He was bound to the bottom of the pole.
In Laramie, Wyoming, a young gay man is in a deep coma from a savage beating.
This could be any main drag in America. Fast food chains, gas stations.
When you're seeing someone who's been beaten repeatedly by someone in our own town, now that certainly offends us.
My students need to talk. They started to talk about it, and then the media descended and all dialogue stopped.
Laramie, Wyoming.
This small city that bills itself as Wyoming's hometown
is now at the eye of the storm.
In jail now, charged with a crime.
I am outraged and sick of
this. Deputies found the man badly beaten and unconscious.
So this is not the University of Wyoming. This is not what we're about.
You have your own lifestyle. You should have your lifestyle.
It's pretty much live and let live.
Live and let live.
That is such crap. If I don't tell you I'm a fag, you won't beat the crap out of me.
The perpetrators themselves were kids. Local kids that everyone who's from around here has some relationship to.
We don't grow children like that here. Well, it's pretty clear we do grow children like that here.
Aaron said him and Russ decided to pretend that they were gay and get him in the truck and rob him.
What's he look like?
I look queer.
They wanted to teach him a lesson not to come on to straight people.
I could have stopped it. I should have known. These guys should not have been talking to that guy.
It seems to be partially his fault and partially the guys who did it. Maybe it's 50-50.
A couple of days later, they showed me a picture of Matthew. I would have never recognized him.
I hope before he slipped into a coma,
he had a chance to reflect on his lifestyle.
I was brought up to love the sinner, hate the sin. Love the person for who they are, but condemn them for what they do.
Hate crime's a hate crime. You murder somebody, you hate them. It has nothing to do if you're a gay or a prostitute or... I don't understand.
We need to own this crime, I feel. Everyone needs to own it.
This is the time to begin the healing process. To show mercy to someone who refused to show any mercy.
10 years later, the Tectonic Theater Project returned to Laramie, Wyoming, to see how Matthew's story had changed the town. One of the people Greg Pirati interviewed was Aaron McKinney, the man who killed Matthew Shepard.
You know, it was pretty intense talking to him because, I don't know, I mean, I really believe, you know, that people are intrinsically good. And so, and I do believe that, I still believe that, I believe that about people. But, you know, it was really, really difficult for me to see the lack of remorse that Aaron experienced for what he did. It was really disappointing and disheartening to me to see that he, you know, had no capacity to access that part of himself that would recognize that this was wrong, you know, that, like, he just couldn't get there, you know. And I mean, he has the capacity for remorse because he felt remorseful and guilty that he dragged Russell into the situation and feels personally responsible for, you know, getting Russell, ruining Russell's life, basically. And he felt remorse for that. He felt remorse for disappointing his father. So, you know, he has that capacity, and he just has no ability to experience that around Matthew and what he did.
A worldwide simultaneous reading of the Laramie Project epilogue debuted on October 12, 2009, the 11th anniversary of Matthew's death. The Laramie Project play continues to be produced every year by high schools, colleges, and local theater groups. It's become an important piece of Matthew's legacy.
Showers of your crimson blood seep into a nation, calling up a flood of narrow minds who legislate thinly veiled intolerance, bigotry and hate. But they tortured you and burned you, they beat you and they tied you, they left you cold and breathing. For love they crucified you. I can't forget, hard as I try, this silhouette against the sky.
You're listening to Outbeat Remembers Matthew Shepard and How He Changed the World on KRCB-FM Santa Rosa.
Neglect, I can forgive.
That was Melissa Etheridge with Scarecrow, the song she wrote about Matthew Shepard. One of the people in Laramie, Wyoming who's been most outspoken about how the case changed his life is David O'Malley, the lead investigator from the Laramie Police Department.
On October of 1998, before I knew who Matt Shepard was, I was as mean-spirited and homophobic and as bad-mouthing or hate-speaking about gay people as you could imagine. And when this happened, I was thrust into a situation where I had to interact with the gay community. I didn't have a choice. I was a professional, and my feelings concerning anything would not affect or impact how I did my job. But it certainly made me aware that there was a gay community in Laramie, and I quickly started to lose my ignorance and figure out that all of my belief structures and things that I have developed over the years were based on what somebody else said, not on formed a basis of knowledge and me going out and finding that out by myself. So to make a really long story short, what happened was I figured out that I had precluded a huge group of people from being friends over the majority of my life, and I've spent the last 11 years trying to make up for that. You know, I read one time, you can't go back and make a new start, but you can start how to make a new ending. The discrimination and the hatred and the bias towards the gay community that I have seen since I've been able to open my eyes and see it is phenomenal.
Almost immediately after the investigation began, Dave O'Malley became an outspoken advocate for expanding federal hate crime law to include sexual orientation. He joined the Shepard family and the late Senator Ted Kennedy in a fight that would take more than 12 years to win.
Today, this body has the chance to break the silence. It has a chance to speak with one voice in support of the value of every individual in our society. Join me and my colleagues in breaking the silence. Make the fight to end violence driven by bigotry the high national priority that it should be. Now is the time, because as Reverend Martin Luther King reminded us, the time is always right to do what is right. Now is the time for Congress to speak with one voice and insist that all Americans will be guaranteed the equal protections of the law. I urge all my colleagues to support this amendment.
And indeed, the majority of his colleagues did support him. On October 28, 2009, the Matthew Shepard James Byrd Jr. Act was signed into law by President Barack Obama.
You know, as a nation, we've come far on the journey towards a more perfect union. And today we've taken another step forward. This afternoon I signed into law the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act. This is the culmination of a struggle that has lasted more than a decade. Now, time and again, we faced opposition. Time and again, the measure was defeated or delayed. Time and again, we've been reminded of the difficulty of building a nation in which we're all free to live and love as we see fit. But the cause endured, and the struggle continued, waged by the family of Matthew Shepard, by the family of James Byrd, by folks who held vigils and led marches, by those who rallied and organized and refused to give up. Now, you understand that we must stand against crimes that are meant not only to break bones, but to break spirits. Not only to inflict harm, but to instill fear. You understand that the rights afforded every citizen under our Constitution mean nothing if we do not protect those rights, both from unjust laws and violent acts. And you understand how necessary this law continues to be. In the most recent year for which we have data, the FBI reported roughly 7,600 hate crimes in this country. Over the past 10 years, there were more than 12,000 reported hate crimes based on sexual orientation alone. And we will never know how many incidents were never reported at all. And that's why, through this law, we will strengthen the protections against crimes based on the color of your skin, the faith in your heart, or the place of your birth. We will finally add federal protections against crimes based on gender, disability, gender identity, or sexual orientation. Because no one in America should ever be afraid to walk down the street holding the hands of the person they love. No one in America should be forced to look over their shoulder because of who they are, because they live with a disability. Now, at root, this isn't just about our laws, this is about who we are as a people. This is about whether we value one another, whether we embrace our differences rather than allowing them to become a source of animus. It's hard for any of us to imagine the mindset of someone who would kidnap a young man, beat him to within an inch of his life, tie him to a fence, and leave him for dead. It's hard for any of us to imagine the twisted mentality of those who'd offer a neighbor a ride home, attack him, chain him to the back of a truck, and drag him for miles until he finally died. But we sense where such cruelty begins, the moment we fail to see in another our common humanity, the very moment when we fail to recognize in a person the same fears and hopes, the same passions and imperfections, the same dreams that we all share. We have for centuries strived to live up to our founding ideal of a nation where all are free and equal and able to pursue their own version of happiness. Through conflict and tumult, through the morass of hatred and prejudice, through periods of division and discord, we have endured and grown stronger and fairer and freer. And at every turn, we've made progress not only by changing laws, but by changing hearts, by our willingness to walk in another's shoes, by our capacity to love and accept even in the face of rage and bigotry. In April of 1968, just 1 week after the assassination of Martin Luther King, as our nation mourned in grief and shuddered in anger, President Lyndon Johnson signed landmark civil rights legislation. This is the first time we enshrined into law federal protections against crimes motivated by religious or racial hatred, the law on which we build today. As he signed his name at a difficult moment for our country, President Johnson said that through this law, the bells of freedom ring out a little louder. That is the promise of America. Over the sound of hatred and chaos, over the din of grief and anger, we can still hear those ideals, even when they are faint, even when some would try to drown them out. At our best, we seek to make sure those ideals can be heard and felt by Americans everywhere. And that work did not end in 1968. It certainly does not end today, but because of the efforts of the folks in this room, particularly those family members who are standing behind me, we can be proud that the bell rings even louder now, and each day grows louder still.
Matthew's parents, Judy and Dennis, and his younger brother, Logan, were there with the president to witness the signing of the Matthew Shepard Act into law. And this law is clearly one of the most visible elements of Matthew's legacy. But who was Matthew Shepard? Both MTV and NBC produced movies about what happened, but neither film captured who Matt Shepard really was.
Even when he was a toddler, he would come sit on your lap and say, "What's the matter with you? Did something happen to you today? Did you have a bad day?" He had a terrible temper. And when things didn't go right, he could throw a fit royal and argue that the sky was yellow when you knew it was blue. And he was like that through his whole life. He enjoyed the debate very much.
The thing I remember most about Matt was his incredible smile. His entire body would smile and his eyes would light up and sparkle. It was just kind of an infectious smile that made your day better.
Matt was everybody's friend. He was just the kindest person, someone you could trust, someone you could go to. I mean, he was just a very caring person. He was involved in the arts and theater. He's kind of larger than life. He's very over the top in everything that he does.
Our father's fighting for it.
Matt's dreams for his college education included political science and languages. He was very good at languages. He was fluent in German, Italian, somewhat French, knew some Arabic and Japanese.
Matt always talked about wanting to make a difference in the world. I think we all want to do that somehow.
The best account of who Matt was can be found in the book written by Judy Shepard called The Meaning of Matthew. It's one of many books written about Matthew and what happened to him back in 1998, but it's the only one told by his mother. For young people today, the story of Matthew Shepard is one they only hear about. Many young people in high school and college were just simply too young to be aware or to feel the emotional impact of that day back in October of 1998. But still, Matthew's story has great meaning to young people like Denny Terrio. Denny is a young actor who lives in Canada and recently posted this video on YouTube.
And there you have it. The end result of more than 10 years of lobbying to get the hate crimes bill signed into law. But how did this fight begin? It started with a deplorable act of violence against a young man named Matthew Shepard. Have you ever heard his story? I haven't. Mind you, I was 12 when the events occurred. It wasn't until 2002 when I saw the film version of the events, The Laramie Project, that I fully grasped exactly what happened to Matthew. He was just a 21-year-old out gay man living his day-to-day life, until two people decided to end it all for him. He was tied to a fence, tortured, and left for dead. When I saw The Laramie Project for the first time, I was still very much in the closet myself. I thought to myself, I can be killed simply for being myself. But now in hindsight, I realize all the good that's come from this tragic event. Matthew's death, although violent and unnecessary, did serve a purpose. It empowered youth. It empowered everybody. It empowered me. I know that I wouldn't be here right now talking to you guys on YouTube as an out, gay, and proud man if it weren't for all the events that have transpired since Matthew's death. The Laramie Project, first as a stage play, and then subsequently as a film, has taught people all over the world about tolerance and acceptance. And as you saw at the beginning, the Matthew Shepard Act was signed into law by Barack Obama. And that was thanks to, among other things, Jimmy and Dennis Shepard lobbying for their son's memory and trying to make sure that something so horrible never happens again. And just talking about this drives home a message that I've been trying to convey for a long time. We're all human beings. We all deserve the same rights. What do you care what I do in my bedroom? I don't go into your bedroom and try to dictate what happens. Let me live my life, and let me do what makes me happy. Judy's always said that Matthew was no hero, he was no angel, he wasn't perfect. He was just like any other kid. You see what I'm getting at? This could have happened to any of us. It just so happened that fate chose Matthew. But in the end, it gave us this great gift. And like I always say, tell the people in your life that you love them. Because you never know when that chance will pass. Thank you so much for listening. And I hope you guys learned a little bit more about Matthew's story. And if you guys want a bit more information on Matthew and the Matthew Shepard Foundation and what Judy and Dennis are doing today, visit matthewsplace.com. There's plenty of information, essays, videos. And if you are struggling with your sexuality, tell someone. Contact me. Contact your friends. Tell someone you trust first. Start with that. I promise you there will be someone out there that will listen to you and will care.
I think initially the story of Matthew and what happened to Matthew Shepard, you know, it did scare me because he pretty much got, murdered for being who he was, because he was living his life, like, out and proud, as far as I could tell. And he, you know, someone took his life because of it. So to me, like, to a 14, 15-year-old kid, it's who's struggling with that already, and then to hear that, it really did scare me, you know? I didn't really think something like that could happen in Fredericton. I'd like to think that people were still a little bit more open-minded than that, but initially it definitely did scare me. Now, again, since last year starting the whole YouTube thing, I realized that everything, like, it's almost like Matthew's death was a catalyst, and everything that's happened since his death, especially on the part of Judy and Dennis, it started this whole perpetual, it started this whole big movement, you know, and a lot of kids around that time and up until now have gained strength, and you know, it enraged, you know, our generation, and it made them want to be more active in what happens in politics and concerned with, like, human rights and things like that. So, you know, in the end, I think from such a brutal crime, so much good has come out of it, you know, and like I talk in the video too, the Matthew Shepard Act was signed, you know, it took a good while to happen, but, you know, maybe it wouldn't have happened so soon if it weren't for what happened to Matthew.
Matthew's story will indeed be kept alive by not only those songs, books, and movies that have already been published, but like new projects, like the movie a group of his friends are producing called Matt Shepard is a Friend of Mine.
Hi, my name is Michelle Husway, and I'm the director of a feature-length documentary about my friend Matthew Shepard, who was murdered in 1998. You may or may not remember his story. 12 years ago, 21-year-old Matthew Shepard met two young men at a bar in Laramie, Wyoming. These men kidnapped, robbed, and tortured Matt. They beat him severely and tied him to a fence where he lay until he was found 18 hours later. Their only reason for doing all of this to Matt was because he was gay. Matt was one of my closest friends in high school, one of the kindest, most generous, and hilarious people I've ever known. When he died, it was devastating. And it's only been until recently that I've been able to articulate what his friendship and his passing have meant to me. But Matthew Shepard means so much to so many people, and I, along with his family and friends, feel that it's so important to share with the world the story of our Matt, the one behind the headlines.
So it was 5 o'clock in the morning, and the phone rang, and we thought, well, it's Matt, because he always called early. It was the hospital in Laramie.
I saw a form of Matthew in bandages.
Matt's been brought in after being beaten severely. Really, his face was so swollen, we weren't even sure it was Matt.
My mom told me to turn on the television, and that's when I heard the specifics of everything.
Matt's story is all over the internet, the newspaper, the radio, the television.
It's everywhere you look.
He was murdered over $20 in a pair of shoes. You know, that's kind of what it boils down to at the end of the day.
You're always going to replay that night in your head and think, like, what could I have done?
Keep thinking and thinking, wondering why you weren't there to protect him.
You don't ever think things like that are going to happen to people that you know or that are close to you.
I mean, every day I think about him. In some way, there's something that makes me remember him.
I don't want to think about him out there in that prairie in that cold weather. I don't want to think about it anymore.
The sky was his blanket. The wind was his cover for the night.
There's always going to be those wounds, and they, you know, they sometimes a wound cuts so deep you can't heal it, you know.
And his death linked all of us. It's been 12 years since Matt died. I think this is a journey that we're here to kind of get to know who he was and dedicate this time to him.
It's cathartic, really, being in these physical places that I've only, you know, read about or talked about with friends and his family, so it's overwhelming.
To me, I see it as that we're honoring him.
I don't think we could even talk about it till now.
And for all the people Matthew's life has touched, it's clear no one has been changed more than his mother Judy, his father Dennis, and his brother Logan. And despite all they've been through, all three of them continue to be involved in making Matt's dream come true through the Matthew Shepard Foundation. And 10 years after reading about Matthew Shepard and writing the song What Matters, singer-songwriter Randy Driscoll reflected on how Matthew's story has changed her life.
Love is Love is a song that I wrote. It was around the time of, there was an election happening, and we had a big thing going on in California with Prop 8. And as much as there was sort of a lot of negativity, I still really felt hopeful. I mean, I had worked now with the Matthew Shepard Foundation for over 10 years, and I felt that there was a lot of positive change happening. I mean, a lot of progress, but still so much work to be done. So I went to my keyboard, same thing, and I kind of wanted to process that feeling, and I intentionally wanted to write sort of my What Matters 10 years later. And so Love is Love is a very upbeat, whereas What Matters is more of a ballad. Love is Love is much more upbeat. It's more, you know, faster paced, and it talks sort of about, you know, really the change that I see coming, the change on the horizon, and this feeling of sort of like love and change kind of washing over the land, and it's really my dream of where I think we can be. I mean, there's lines in there about, you know, parents holding their children, sons and daughters coming together, a bridge that kind of brings two sides together. Those are all images that I really firmly believe that we can get to. I think we're getting there. I think we still have a ways to go, but I believe that if we keep moving in the way that we're moving, the work of the Matthew Shepard Foundation, what they're doing to try to end hate, try to end hate speech, I think if we just keep on that track, I really see it happening. And so that song is sort of my my uplifting, you know, what matters on the other side, how we are on the other side 10 years later.
It's truly impossible to capture in just 1 hour the full scope of how Matthew Shepard changed the world. His story changed my life forever, and I consider him to be the best friend I never knew. If you'd like to learn more about the Matthew Shepard Foundation, please go to their website at matthewshepard.org. Our special thanks to Randy Driscoll, Greg Perotti, David O'Malley, Denny Terrio, the Tectonic Theater Project, HBO, and everyone at the Matthew Shepard Foundation. For Outbeat Radio, I'm Greg Moralia.